Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, a Bulwark contributor, and I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and an Atlantic contributor. Elliot, how are you this balmy day?
I'm doing well. I missed the session with Tim Bovary about the Grand Alliance during World War II, but I've been reading his book on appeasement, which is magnificent. I mean, I like the other one too, but I think this one is even better. And what particularly strikes me about it is it really restores the moral critique of the appeasers. I'm not sure he started off that way. But he certainly ended up that way. And they're just all kinds of little tidbits. He's looked into lots of different archives and collections of personal letters. I hadn't realized, among other things, that Neville Chamberlain, through kind of a operative in the Conservative Party, was a former MI5 officer, had the phones of his opponents tapped. So he was listening in on Churchill's phone calls, and clearly no scruples about that. And he also just comes across as at best, a naive and deeply stupid man. So it's a great book. It's unfortunately, I think it resonates for our time. Yeah, we should. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say it's because Tim is a popular historian. It's a useful corrective to the trend in scholarship, I would say, over the last 15 years, which has been to some degree resuscitate Chamberlain and his reputation. There's an element of it, like all historical swings of reputation, that is valid, which is to the point that I think you and I have discussed maybe previously, if not on this podcast, then certainly in our own conversations. The John Lukacs book on 5 days in May makes it quite clear that in that very crucial period where Chamberlain was, where Churchill rather was considering with the War Cabinet how to respond to the feelers from Mussolini about brokering a peace after the fall of France, and Chamberlain actually stood behind Churchill in his effort to keep the War Cabinet from pursuing that, which is what Halifax, who had been the alternative candidate to Churchill as Chamberlain's successor, wanted to do.
Yes.
And that led, of course, to Churchill's, a year or so later when Chamberlain passed, his pretty startling, positive eulogy of Chamberlain. But the rest of the case, basically is, that Britain wasn't ready for war. The chiefs of the Imperial General Staff were all telling Chamberlain that he needed to be, he needed to postpone things until 1942 when they would be ready to fight Hitler. And, all of this is, in my view, just a lot of persiflage, to cover up the moral bankruptcy of the policy.
He shows just how morally bankrupt it was. And contrary to the view that, Chamberlain was being very hard-headed, he was not. I mean, he really thought he had a real deal with Hitler. The idea, one of the justifications was supposedly, well, they bought time. Actually, the Germans did much more with the additional year that they got than the British did. And in fact, Chamberlain, I hadn't realized this, he opposed additional spending on the Royal Air Force after this, when Lord Swinton was pushing for it. And he's very good about documenting something that our late friend Wick Murray did in his excellent book on the balance of power at Munich, yeah, which is, the Germans were not ready for war in 1938 in no way, shape, or form. And, the West Wall hadn't been built. They had 8 divisions in the West against 23 French ones. The other thing that's truly shameful is the way the British military deliberately misread the ability of the Czechs, because the Czechs had a very large, very well-equipped army. And it actually was ready to fight. And parts of British intelligence knew that And the generals decided that they were going to, you know, say, no, they're really not ready, which simply not true.
Well, let's bring this up to the present day, because it will actually get us into the subject we want to talk about, although I don't want to lose our opportunity to cover the jackassery of the week, which maybe we could do later rather than at the top of the show, which is that to your point about the Czechs and their ability to withstand the defenses, there is a very, compelling parallel between giving up the Sudetenland, which the Czechs had fortified,
right,
and were therefore prepared to defend, and having given it up at Munich, found themselves defenseless, really, against the Wehrmacht when it crossed the border and came in the aftermath of the conference in Munich. And what people are asking the Ukrainians to do with the remainder of Donetsk and Luhansk. I mean, there's a very small part of Luhansk Oblast that the Ukrainians still control, about 12 or maybe a little bit more percent of Donetsk Oblast, but they have fortified those with a belt of fortresses and logistical hubs and defense industry, and giving it up would leave them at the mercy of the Russians.
Right. And by the way, you're right. I mean, the parallels are quite interesting, because the Czechs had fortified the Sudeten area, which is mountainous. So it was a natural frontier. And the Germans, this is actually, I think, in Williamson Murray's book, after they complete the overrunning of Czechoslovakia, they inspect the fortresses and the fortifications, which were very, very well engineered. And they said, boy, this would have been even harder than we thought. Of course, we now know, and you cannot blame, I suppose, Chamberlain for not knowing this, there would have been a coup against Hitler if he had actually gone to war. But the other thing, which I think is also relevant to our current moment, is by letting Czechoslovakia go down the drain, you actually gave this tremendous boost to Hitler, because he very quickly gets the arms industry of Czechoslovakia. We forget that Czechoslovakia had, partly because of the role it had played in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, a fantastic arms industry. You know, I think a very large percentage of the tanks that roll into France are actually Czech tanks.
Yeah, built in Czech lands, right? Absolutely. Right.
And, they had a very large small arms industry. So, you know, there was this accretion of power to Hitler, which the British didn't take into account at all. And even beyond that, there was political consequences, which is, you have this tremendous expansion of German influence into Yugoslavia, Romania, Bulgaria as a result of this. So there's, there are parallels here, because we tend not to think, well, what happens if the Ukrainians cave and the Russians get Ukraine, or they basically neuter it, or they reduce it to a kind of a puppet state, which is sort of what happened, with initially with the kind of the rump Czech state. And, the answer is you lose a lot. So the parallels are there. I do, if it's okay with you, though, I really would like to do the jackasseries.
Go ahead. And then we can return to, we can return to appeasement in its modern day form.
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel that I may have with you and some of our listeners blotted my copybook last week by saying one or two moderately nice things about Trump, although heavily qualified, I have to stipulate.
You could say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
All right. So my jackassery, the jackassery of the week, which really stands out to me, is even though there's a government shutdown and with extraordinary speed and not going through any of the procedures and the architectural consultations that you're supposed to. Here in Washington, they have already begun demolishing the East Wing of the White House in order to put up Trump's ballroom. This ballroom is going to be 90,000 square feet. The White House is 55,000 square feet. So it's completely out of scale. This is, I always make a point of saying, look, he's not Mussolini, he's not Hitler, he's not Saddam Hussein. But I think you and I have both stayed in Saddam Hussein's palaces, right?
Yeah.
Baghdad.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of monumentalist, kitsch, outsized architecture that dictators, or in this case, would-be dictators, really love, you know, preferably with lots of gold leaf. The main thing, though, I do remember from Saddam's palaces is the toilets didn't really work all that well. So I don't know if that's going to be the case here, too. But it is something revealing about, you know, the mindset of an authoritarian, which Trump clearly is, that they like these kind of big, gaudy, you know, tasteless, outsized buildings. And it's, you know, I'm sure a reflection of their ego. But in any case, that's my jackassery, and I'm hoping I'm in everybody's good graces now.
Well, you know, you've picked on a open wound here for me. I mean, you know, having worked in the White House and revering it as the people's house, you know, watching, you know, the jackhammers and backhoes, you know, destroying, you know, the entire East Wing. But by the way, it's a lie. It reveals a lie when he said when he was going to build this big gargantuan monument to himself that that it wouldn't touch the East Wing and it wouldn't, you know, disturb the current footprint of the building. You know, our Bulwark listeners and viewers, I'm sure, will have already read JVL's diatribe against this and Mona Charon's as well. So I join you in thinking this is like rank jackassery. But I have other examples as well. I mean,
do tell.
So we've talked about the press rules that Pete Hegseth is trying to impose, essentially prior restraint on the press corps at the Pentagon. To their credit, almost the entire Pentagon press corps has refused to sign up to this. But, you know, we do have a large coterie of right-wing influencers, podcasters, TikTok personalities who apparently are being credentialed, including some who've taken money from Russian government efforts to seed disinformation in the United States. So, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I present you with your current sanctioned Pentagon press corps. I would note that the Turkish press is well represented, and I guess that's a good thing because they can explain to the others what the deep state really is. I would also note, you know, our intrepid producer pointed out to us in the green room that we also must mention the live fire exercise that was done for Secretary Hegseth and Vice President Vance out at 29 Palms, which resulted in a live fire demonstration and a shell exploding over Interstate 5, which thank God was shut down at the time, but did damage a California Highway Patrol vehicle and I think a motorcycle as well.
Yeah, and of course, J.D. Vance was inappropriately political. Yeah, no, I mean, these guys are producing as much jackassery as the Shield of the Republic can possibly identify and consume. I do think, though, I wonder if, you know, the motto for this week's podcast should be jackasses with jackhammers, because that's what we're looking at.
Clowns with flamethrowers and jackasses with jackhammers. Well, let's turn to the to the Ukraine, and the parallel there with appeasement, as we discussed at the top, is really quite striking. So, the president was supposed to meet previously scheduled appointment with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, on Friday. The president had been talking for weeks about, since the failure essentially of the Alaska summit to yield a subsequent meeting and any change in the Russian disposition to pursue its maximalist objectives in Ukraine, had been brooding about the idea that he might provide Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles to Ukraine. The Ukrainians were in town before the Friday meeting, talking with senior officials at Lockheed Martin and at Raytheon, because Tomahawk land attack missile, a very, very capable weapon, would have extended the range of Ukraine's ranged missile and drone campaign against Russian military and economic targets by, you know, about 800 miles from about the 190-mile range of the ATACMS missiles that they've been provided, with about 1,000-mile range with the TLAMs. They would have needed something to fire them from, because TLAMs in our inventory are fired from surface ships and attack submarines. And obviously Ukraine doesn't have any of those. So they were talking with U.S. defense industry about what launch vehicles they might use to fire these missiles. And all of that, you know, went up in smoke after Putin called the president, and then the president and Steve Witkoff, his intrepid negotiator, essentially repeated the talking points that they had heard from Putin in the phone call on Thursday in the meeting with Zelensky, essentially saying, give up, you know, these fortified areas and you can have a ceasefire. And Zelensky, to his credit, resisted all that pressure. And now here we are, the promised meeting between Trump and Putin, which would have been in Budapest, which would have been a terrible place to hold such a meeting, is off now. It's not going to happen again. But Putin has succeeded in his objective, which was to get in the way of the provision of Tomahawks. I mean, David Kramer and I have a lengthy article in the Dispatch, which we'll put in the show notes, about this. The thing that's really striking is how well, you know, Putin, as a former KGB case officer, has figured out how to push Trump's buttons. He knows how to appeal to Trump. And if you read the Russian readout of this, starts with a slathering of praise for the Gaza ceasefire. It then goes on to talk about how Russia is winning, you know, in all phases of the war. There's no hope for Ukraine. Tomahawk missiles won't do anything to change the situation on the battlefield, but they would be extremely escalatory and would get in the way of all the wonderful U.S.-Russian economic cooperation and trade and investment that could go on if only we could get past this slight unpleasantness in Ukraine. Anyway, end of rant.
This is one where I have a different, different take from a lot of the commentary, and not the one that's more flattering to Trump. Don't get me wrong, but I watch this. So if you recall, the public discussion of the meeting was, you know, probably not the Tomahawks, but it didn't sound like it had been an awful meeting. Then there's a piece in the Financial Times saying, no, actually Trump was yelling and screaming, and, you know, Witkoff was being an idiot. Zelensky was a native Russian speaker. So Witkoff is saying, well, those people are native Russian speakers, so of course they want to be Russians. Same way the Irish, you know, like most of them, native English speakers too, which is why they wanted to be English. So the FT breaks the story, and then other outlets confirm it. So here's my first thought about this was, well, this is interesting, because that was not Trump's public presentation of this. His public remarks were probably not Tomahawk. Maybe, I don't know. I think they're losing. They could still win. It's war. You know, it's complicated. And then this story comes out. So first, it's very striking to me that this is not how he presented it. Secondly, that he does cancel the meeting with Putin. I mean, you're right. Putin knows how to manipulate him, but so does Mark Rutte. I mean, so does everybody else at this stage. I mean, it's not that hard a code to break. And the thing that really hit me about this, and I'd be curious about what your reaction is, you know, all of us, I think, are very fixated on the issues because we're issue kind of people, right? So we're focused on Ukraine. And of course, we all have friends who are really focused on tariffs or focused on Gaza or focused on the immigration stuff or focused on the corruption of DOJ or any of a number of other issues. And there's a problem with that because, in a way, the challenge is to understand from looking from Trump out rather than from issues in, if you see what I'm saying. And I think here what I think about this is we have evidence here that Trump is, if anything, growing more and more erratic. My strong suspicion is, yes, he blew his stack. That may have been tactical, but I think this is evidence of a guy who, A, I believe is in mental decline. And I thought that's been visible in a number of the speeches that he's given. You know, the psychologists say, well, count the number of polysyllabic words that he uses, which have gone down, and things like that. You know, there are these indications that he's not in physical good health, this bruising on the hands and edema in the legs, stuff like that. He has been traveling a hell of a lot. We know that he doesn't sleep well. We know that he doesn't eat a particularly healthy diet. And if you think about the stuff that's cascading on him, there's the Gaza thing falling apart, which will, or possibly falling apart, which we'll discuss. His polls are in, you know, he's doing very badly in the polls. We'll be talking later on about the No Kings stuff. We can talk later on about the courts and the extent to which the courts actually have stymied him on a whole bunch of things. You're beginning to see people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, kind of break with him. So my take is, this is a guy who's, you know, had a few screws loose, quite a few screws loose to begin with, who's under and who is declining, probably physically, probably mentally as well, who is under an enormous amount of strain. And you and I have both seen presidents up close, and you know, you can tell the effect of the strain. And that's when they have around them a well-designed process. They are well-staffed. You know, they are taking decisions in a careful, deliberate way, whether or not we, you know, always agree with them. That's not what it is. You know, what a friend of mine had a great way of putting it. He said, you know, this is somebody at a local think tank. He said, you know, I don't really see the point in writing anything for the government because there's this air gap now between the people who might read anything I write and the people who are actually calling the shots on any issue. You know, it's Steve Witkoff, Steve Miller, you know, Trump, maybe J.D. Vance occasionally, maybe Hegseth, but it's a tiny group. And they're not well-staffed. And by the way, for the last thing, and then I'll stop and wait your comments. I think I may have mentioned this the last time as well, but it's worth repeating. I was getting together with a former ambassador, retired now from the State Department, and I said to him, "What do you hear?" And he said, "Well, you know, Tara, they're really mean to the Foreign Service," and of course he would care about a lot. And I said, he said, "The only good news is they hate each other even more." So you know, this is not a band of brothers. So I put all those things together, and the picture that it paints for me is not so much, okay, we finally have evidence that Trump is a Russian agent. It's that we have evidence that Trump is under a lot of pressure, that he's deteriorating. He's likely to get more erratic if he doesn't have some sort of collapse.
Well, I agree with most of that. I mean, first of all, you know, you have to start with, you know, the premise that Trump knows very little about any of this. I mean, one of the things he's reputed to have said, and there are a couple of different accounts of this in this meeting, was, "I don't want to see these maps you keep showing me of the front line. It's a place I've never been, you know, and I don't care about." And he said in the Oval the other day when asked about the war in Ukraine, "It doesn't matter to us. It doesn't affect us," you know, which is not far from, you know, Chamberlain's comment that, right, you know, that Czechoslovakia was a faraway people, you know, of whom
we know little.
So there's that. He also doesn't really believe in anything. I mean, he doesn't have any fixed principles other than sort of accreting power and wealth to himself and to his family and cronies. So therefore, the, you know, sort of inconstancy is not, you know, altogether surprising. And then when I think you layer on the things that, you said, clearly in mental and physical decline. I mean, he's essentially 80 years old now, and or approaching 80, And that's a, you know, we know that's an age after which people can decline quite precipitously. So I agree with all that. I still think that, you know, there is, as Ed Luce in the Financial Times in a column said this week, this mesmeric hold that Putin has on him. I mean, his ability to influence Trump, it's true that others have broken the code, as you say, about Trump, but Putin seems to be particularly adept at it. And part of that is because he was, that's what he was trained to do as a KGB officer, was to assess people, to figure out their foibles, their weaknesses, and to exploit them. So, I mean, this is his profession.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But, you know, I also, I suspect some of this is, you know, because this is a guy who doesn't read, and this is a guy who has not really, I suspect, changed his views about many things. So when would his, you know, his basic impressions about international politics, which to which he never paid a whole lot of attention, have been formed? At the height of the Cold War. So I suspect that there's this kind of lingering notion, even though one half of them knows that, yeah, their economy is in big trouble, and it's, you know, a fraction of what it used to be. I think that sort of thing lingers the same way. If, you know, it took them a long time to get over the idea that the Japanese are not the major economic challenge for the United States. I think he also, and this is, you know, the kind of cold, brutal side of him, is he's sort of impressed that they're willing to take a million casualties, although he thinks they're, he also thinks they're idiots. I mean, I think that's pretty clear as well. But, you know, for me, what this indicates is the thing we should be looking for are more signs of decline, because, you know, we've just lived through having a president who is in decline. There were a lot of little tells that were visible to those of us on the outside. There was much more that was available on the inside, and they didn't share. These guys will share even less. But I think it's something to keep an eye out for, because I think it'll affect a whole bunch of things.
Yeah. As to the characterization of the meeting, you know, look, there, in my view, there's a, you know, it's sort of like Murder on the Orient Express, right? You know, everybody here has a motive for not really, you know, talking about how bad this meeting was. And my sense of it was not as bad as the ambush in the Oval last spring.
It was bad.
But it was bad. And here's why nobody, you know, came out and said, oh, bad meeting, the way they did. You know, it was so visible. Part of it was what happened back in, late February was it was live broadcast. They were live streaming it. And so it was very hard to, you know, obfuscate how bad the meeting was. I think Trump and his, you know, his coterie understand that they had really bad press from that, and including from a lot of Republicans in the Senate who are much more pro-Ukraine than Trump is by nature. They didn't want to go through that again. Zelensky has his own reasons for not wanting this to, you know, completely come out, although I think they were happy to share some details with the press. He's trying to keep the prospect of the Tomahawks alive, and good on him, because maybe they can ultimately get Tomahawks, if not directly from the U.S., maybe indirectly through the allies. And the allies who've been briefed on this also have an interest in keeping Trump on side. What's going on in Europe? They're all, you know, Ruta's coming here to meet with Trump today, as you said, but they're also, they're, you know, got this 12-point peace plan. They had this statement that the 12 of the European leaders put out along with Zelensky about, you know, we agree with President Trump, have to have a ceasefire as the beginning point of negotiations. And we can't have, you know, aggression rewarded by, you know, ceding land to Russia. And we got to put more pressure on them militarily and economically. So everybody had a reason for not, you know, accepting all, you know, not coming out with exactly how bad this meeting was.
Well, I think just a, you know, quick to follow up on that, you know, the first time was shocking. I mean, even you and I, who have a pretty dark view of Donald Trump, were shocked. I think the Ukrainians were shocked. The Europeans were shocked. If you remember, Zelensky goes back and he meets with Starmer and Macron. This time, I think, you know, the thing is, Trump has the same playbook. you know, these kind of suck-ups. So what did they do in this case? They immediately have Mark Rutte, who is probably of all the European leaders other than Stubb, the president of Finland, the guy that Trump feels most comfortable with, locked and loaded, ready to immediately come over. And, you know, so there's that. I also think and here's the interesting things that I'm hearing are that the Europeans and the Ukrainians have realized that we are very unpredictable. We are continuing, apparently, to share intelligence, so it's been reported, and the arms packages go through, although I think Bridge Colby at the Defense Department screws around with it. But it what's clear that they and the Europeans are doing is they're not going to stop developing weapons to do, you know, long-range fires. And what they will do is they will stop putting any American technology into that. So, you know, what somebody may want to point out to Trump, if you can hear it, is, you know, what you're doing is you are giving this tremendous boost to the Ukrainian and the European defense industries. Because I think, you know, what the sense that I get, and to some extent this is based on what I hear, is people aren't, you know, Ukrainians realize they're not going to be able to drive the Russians out of the rest of Donbass and Crimea, not now at least. So you're probably looking at a ceasefire more or less along current lines. But you're not going to get that because the Russians have said they don't want that. They want a peace settlement, which is, you know, a la Munich 1938. The way you're going to get that is by inflicting massive pain, massive and visible pain, not just on the Russian economy, but I think you're going to see much more visible long-range strikes. And it won't be with American technology. We are not the only people who can build effective long-range missiles. And there's been reports about the Ukrainians developing their own long-range system, the Flamingo, but the British have the technology and the French and lots of Germans have that technology. And so I won't be at all surprised if in the next couple of months you begin to see things blowing up in Leningrad or Moscow or places like that.
Well, the Tomahawks in particular, if they can get them, whether from us or from the Europeans, have a particular value in the sense that there's a set of military targets that they could reach. It's not a wonder weapon. There's no silver bullet. But if you could take out the Alabuga drone factory in Tatarstan, which the Iranians essentially built for the Russians, which has been mass producing the drones that are inflicting these, mass sortie. Yep. Attacks on Ukrainian cities, or the Engels Air Force Base in Saratov, from whence the Russians launch a lot of these. That's where their long-range strategic aviation is based, and from whence they can launch these cruise missile volleys that go along with the drones. That would have, a significant impact, as well as the continuing attack on the energy, the pumping stations, the oil depots, the refineries, et cetera. I mean, they've taken 21% of Russian refining capacity offline, which is, astonishing, really, and is having a real effect on the Russian economy. Look, we could go all day on this one. I want to turn to another topic, which is this is one of the wars Trump is trying to stop. Let's talk about the one he's trying to get us into in Venezuela. I mean, we have now arrayed a flotilla of naval assets, about 8 to 10% of U.S. deployed naval assets, a bigger force than we used to fight the Battle of Midway during World War II, to take out 6 or 7 drug boats, alleged drug boats. There's a word for this, insane.
There's another word, possibly. Illegal.
Yes.
And as you and I were talking about, the fact that the Southern Command commander, Admiral Hoxley, resigned, I think, less than a year into his position.
Yep.
This has to be connected to that. And I think my sense is actually that there are people in Congress, not just Democrats, who are squeamish about this because you know, it's all, look, it's also going to run into the don't get us into foreign wars kind of thing. You know, my hunch on this one is I think probably what the administration is thinking is they can overawe and intimidate Maduro and, you know, incentivize a coup against him, which would achieve what they want. And, you know, there's a kind of rough logic to that. I have no idea whether or not it'll work, but this could easily, they are talking about operations on land. You know, this could end up dragging you into something which you probably don't want.
Yeah, they've got a lot of, you know, in addition to, you know, the naval flotilla, there are a lot of aircraft, both, you know, shipborne and land-based that they've, you know, arrayed down there, F-35s, Apache helicopters, MH-60 Little Birds for the special forces guys. They've got the you know, the commercial special ops vessel down there. I think we're going to see strikes on land. I can't imagine they've got all this firepower down there and they're just going to take out a bunch of cigarette boats and then go home. I think that they're likely to, you know, have some attacks. They may try and snatch Maduro, you know, and spirit him away. I mean, after all, he's been indicted like Noriega was.
Right. So but Noriega, why don't you remind people of what happened with
this was in Bush 41, Manuel Noriega, the president of Panama, was indicted by a U.S. Grand jury in Atlanta for drug running. There was a lot of effort in the late Reagan administration to sort of, you know, try and get, you know, do what they're trying to do here, either, you know, prompt a coup or Noriega to surrender himself. He didn't do it. We ended up invading Panama. That's a totally different situation. I mean, that's a situation where, you know, the United States military had still had a lot of knowledge of Panama from the years that we had operated there in the canal zone. It's a very small population. It didn't require a lot of troops. I mean, operations in Venezuela are a whole different kettle of fish and would require a much larger force. And I'm having trouble understanding their theory of victory here. I get what you're saying, that they think they can prompt a coup. To do what? I mean, if one of these corrupt Venezuelan generals, I mean, and they've all been corrupted by the Bolivarian revolution of Chavez and Maduro, you know, succeeds Maduro, it's the same thing. I don't see how you've advanced anything.
Not from Trump's point of view. I think from Trump's point of view, look, you know, for political leaders, but sometimes for military leaders too, what they want to do is collect scalps. I mean, it's really comes down to that. And if he can claim Maduro's scalp, at some level, he almost doesn't care whether the drug traffic continues under a different corrupt general, because he will have, you know, brought that deathly threat to the United States to an end. And you're right. If you're substantive, you would say, no, actually, you know, what you would really care about is, can Venezuela become some kind of return to what it was, or something better than what it was, which was kind of an oligarchy, you know, maybe kind of work its way to being a liberal democracy. The thing is, I think if that's what they're thinking, they vastly underestimate the amount of work that would have to go into that. Now, you're right. I mean, Venezuela is a huge country. Panama is a tiny country. We still had a presence there. People were quite happy to see Noriega go. I mean, most Venezuelans, I'm sure, would be happy to see Maduro go, but there'll be, you know, enough people to give you trouble who will not want to see American soldiers or Marines in Venezuela.
I mean, the other thing here is, I mean, they've produced absolutely no evidence that the boats that they're hitting are, in fact, drug boats. I mean, you were saying that this is likely illegal. It's likely illegal because this is not an armed force of any kind that we should be using military force to, as opposed to Coast Guard law enforcement to deal with. Even there, you know, there are issues. Rand Paul has pointed out, when the Coast Guard interdicts drug boats, that 25% of the time they, you know, they're finding boats that are innocent, not what they thought they were. So, you know, who knows what we're actually hitting here? The fact that they're, you know, they think that it's okay to use military force to take these guys out, but they had two survivors who they refused to either take to Guantanamo or bring to a court. And they've just repatriated them. They've been let go, which tells you that I don't think they've got the courage of their convictions here on on what it is they're doing. But what they are doing, which is very dangerous in my book, is making U.S. military officers carry out orders that many of them think are illegal or suspect are illegal or are troubled by. And that's a very bad precedent.
It's a terrible precedent. And, you know, but you see it also in small ways, too. If I'd step away from Venezuela for a moment, I have made a point of correcting friends and colleagues who'd refer to it as the Department of War. It's the Department of Defense. Congress has not changed the name of the department. And the president, you know, in the same way the president doesn't get to change the, the title of the United States Army to be the Leibstandarte Donald Trump. And you know, the reason why I raise that is that, you know, that's obviously a more minor thing, but it you know, corrodes the integrity and professionalism of the American military. And that has been such an utterly invaluable asset to this country in ways that I think many people do not understand. It's, you know, one of their more grievous offenses against our constitutional order. And it can only lead to bad things in bad places.
You know, I think it's fair to say that this is not just an opinion that, you know, kind of Waldorf and Statler of the commentariat, you know, two old, you know, kvetching, you know, white Jewish guys are saying about the Department of Defense. There was an astonishing article yesterday in the Washington Times, which is a very Trumpy news outlet, about how the general officers view Hegseth. And it completely validates the view that both you and I expressed on the special Shield of the Republic that we did in the aftermath of the debacle at Quantico, where Hegseth came out and, you know, talked about the importance of grooming standards and, fitness standards and, you know, all this other stuff that as the article argued, would be appropriate for a kind of, you know, 04 military officer, which is what Hegseth was, to be worried about, as opposed to the larger strategic issues that the Secretary of Defense is meant to concern himself with.
Yeah, it also illustrates something else, which is, in a way, this goes back to something you mentioned earlier about, Hegseth trying to control press access. First, stories will get out. You know, the idea that journalists are going to roll over and play dead, or that people are not going to leak to them, that's crazy. And of course, you know, Trump, this is the sort of more extreme case of it, but, you know, the Obama administration was really terrible this way, trying to crack down on people's access to the press and, you know, polygraphs and all that sort of stuff. But the other thing that I think is really important, there was, I think that James Harbord, who I think was in charge of logistics, I think, for the American Expeditionary Force in World War I, once said that, you know, an army doesn't advance unless, in effect, there's a silent vote in favor. That is to say that, you know, soldiers are not simply automatons. I'm sure Hegseth in his own way thinks that they are, or he can turn them into them because that was the kind of control he could exercise over many of his privates, probably not even them. But, you know, with the General Officer Corps, no. And so he may not understand how much he's damaged his own standing and that he should care about that. Because he really should care about that, because that will affect his ability to implement things. I am sure that, here's one thing that I'm quite sure of, that article will have made the coterie around Hegseth even more paranoid than they currently are. They will suspect everybody. And as you know better than I, you know, there's plenty of paranoia as it is in a normal administration in the Pentagon about who's leaking against me and all that. But, and in this case, I think it'll just be pervasive, and that, you know, that paralyzes you, that causes you to make all kinds of mistakes. It's, you know, I mean, I guess leads to my larger point, which is in some ways we may be rescued by their incompetence, but their incompetence could get this country into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. I mean, so the other notable, I mean, you're absolutely right about the paranoia. Look, nobody likes negative stories about them. You know, did I like negative stories about me, of which there were many, when I was Undersecretary of Defense? No, of course not. And sometimes, you know, it is a natural thing to try and look at the story and go, well, where did that come from? You know, who could that possibly be? You know, and that, you know, can be very poisonous. And it's easy to succumb to, you know, really easy, in the best of times. And this is not the best of times. So, yes, I agree. And you can already see elements of that now creeping in, because he's also trying to keep people, the chiefs, the service secretaries, from being able to testify and talk to members of the oversight committees and the Congress. And, you know, that is very difficult, right? Because when you're confirmed, and when I was confirmed, one of the main questions in your advanced policy questions that you get from the Senate Armed Services Committee is, will you give this committee your unvarnished military, best military and defense judgment about policy when we ask you questions? You know, they understand that you're there to represent the administration, but they also, and, you know, look, I had personal experience with this. I mean, I went to Bob Gates at one point and said, there was a certain subject. I said, I cannot testify about this subject because I have no confidence in, you know, what the administration has done. And if I'm called upon, you know, by members of the Congress to give my opinion, I will give it. And he said, I get it. I respect that. I'm going to make sure you don't testify.
Right. Right. Well, he was a class act. And the last thing these guys are a bunch of class acts. All right. So let's move on to another joyous subject, Gaza. You know, the thing that, I mean, and you, to be fair, you really did point this out last time. And I continue to give Trump credit for the ceasefire. But boy, the follow through is going to be hellish. It's already clear they've made some big mistakes. I think one of the biggest mistakes is getting the Qataris and the Turks, particularly the Turks, involved, you know, which is, you know, and I mean, one thing you do hear from the Israelis is they are now quite worried about the Turks, as I believe they should be. You know, we may want to bring our friend Henri Barkey back in, but I think Henri may not be right if in thinking that neo-Ottomanism dies with when Erdogan leaves office. I mean, if you look at it, Turkey's being very assertive, you know, everywhere from Libya to the Persian Gulf to Azerbaijan. And, you know, if you look at particularly Erdogan's rhetoric about Israel, it's violent.
Or his son's rhetoric. Look, first of all, when is Erdogan going to leave office? I mean, he's busy disqualifying anybody who might, you know, run against him. He's trying to work it so that the parliament will, you know, allow him to run, you know, change the constitution to allow him to run for another term. I don't see any sign that he's leaving unless nature takes its course and snatches him away. Look, I mean, the vice president is there now, Witkoff and Kushner. But, you know, they did the easy part. And oh, by the way, look, credit to them for getting the last 20 hostages out. That was terrible. Should be noted that Joe Biden got 175 hostages out.
I mean,
to be fair. The other point, I guess, is that they now have to talk about how are you going to, you know, disarm Hamas. It's great to say that if they don't, you know, don't disarm, they're going to be obliterated. Obliterated by whom? You know, we're not, it's clear we're not going to do the obliteration. Bibi has just replaced his national security advisor who didn't want to go back in. You know,
and by the way, Tzachi Hanegbi was the guy you're talking about, is no moderate,
right,
at all.
The you know, the handpicked army chief of staff that he put in didn't want to go in. What kind of force are you going to, you know, wield? I don't think, you know, the idea that you're going to have some Arab force shooting, you know, Palestinian Arabs in Gaza, that's not going to happen. So who is going to actually, liberate the Gazans from the terror of Hamas, which we've already seen being exercised in the streets, is point one. Point two, you know, they've got this vague idea of this board of peace that Trump is going to kind of be the CEO of, and presumably Tony Blair will be the COO of, to, you know, provide governance to Gaza and oversee the reconstruction. I mean, in theory, there's, you know, something maybe there that could be worked, but this is going to be very hard. And it requires, frankly, a level of professionalism in the diplomacy of this that I don't think that they dispose of right now. So I'm pretty bearish on how this goes going forward.
Yeah, I think what you may end up with after various twists and turns and events is that there will be parts of the strip that the Israelis will actually continue to control, where they will quietly be working with the local clans and local notables, and they will provide the muscle to keep Hamas out. Gaza City, which is still basically run by Hamas, will be kind of isolated, and things will not move. I mean, I hate to say it, but I think that's probably the most likely outcome, because you're absolutely right. By the way, I think one of the other reasons why you're not going to have a third party come in is, you know, Hamas fighters, this is their city. They know it. They have the tunnels. They are used to fighting, and, you know, we would find it challenging. You know, if you sent 1st Marine Division in, they would find it challenging, or 10th Mountain or something like that. It's going to be much worse for Egyptians or Emiratis or Turks.
In my sense, I mean, you've been in Israel, you know, recently. My sense is Israelis are tired and worn out, and now that the hostages are out, want this to be over. There's not a lot of appetite for continuing to do this. No. And there's beginning to be in Israel some coverage, you know, some discussion now of what, you know, what's been wreaked on the civilian population in Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, and, you know, I mean, obviously this was something that they weren't going to turn to really until they got the hostages back. I think there's another element to it as well, which is, to the extent that the idea was that you have the Turks and the Qataris involved, the Israelis, I think, are going to be understandably worried, because on the one hand, they broke the ring of fire that the Iranians built around them. But they look at the Turks in Syria, and they look at, you know, the world awash in Qatari money, and they get worried. There was a good piece, I think, in today's New York Times, was it, about just how incredibly violent the Sunni militias, but also government forces in Syria, were towards the Druze in Sueda. Say something like a couple thousand people killed, and horribly, you know, as is usually happens in that part of the world. And yeah, there's some atrocities on the other side too, but this was basically an anti-Druze pogrom on a large scale. And
it wasn't the first time, right? Because you had, in the spring, you had one against the Alawites. I mean, exactly, that was
1400 people killed, I think.
Yeah, that was sparked by the Iranians, because they were using their last lever in Syria, which was the Alawite population on the coast. But it did lead to this horrible massacre. So yeah, let's turn to the No Kings rallies, because we can then wax euphoric about the American Revolution
So, you know what I think the most important thing about them is that people are waving American flags.
Yeah,
that was the smartest thing. There are two very smart things that whoever this coalition of organizers did was. One was to be quite careful that there would be no violence, and there was virtually no violence. So keeping that under control and having lots of American flags.
And copies of the Declaration of Independence.
Yes. And you know, I mean, this way it helps that we're, you know, we're in the middle of the 250th. And you could tell, I thought, that there's a bit of a tone of desperation in some of the commentary from Republicans in Congress, and certainly from Trump with these. By the way, this is another indication that Trump is more mentally ill than he was before, you know, where he's putting out these AI-generated videos of him flying an airplane, dropping excrement on demonstrators. I mean, it's like seventh grade humor or something like that, or, you know, maybe grade school. I don't know. But you can tell that they're made uneasy by this. And I think they probably should be. I think it's an indication of something deeper that is going to come after them at the midterms. Don't you think?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I never thought I would live to see the day where a president of the United States would think it was okay to put out a fake video of him literally shitting all over the American people. I mean, it's just
from an airplane.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's just hard to, you know, to fathom. We're running short on time, but there's one other issue that we really have to touch on, because it will, I hope, set us up for a future episode of Shield of the Republic, in which we will dig deep into the intellectual ecosystem of MAGA, to the extent that there is such a thing. And that is the fact that the Republican Party seems to have a problem with, you know, some of the appointees and some of its denizens, issuing pro-Nazi texts. You've got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. So on the one hand, fascination with the Nazis goes back a long way, and it's pervasive. It's been pervasive. Look, it's pervasive in Russia. If you think about it, if you think about what Russia's suffered during World War II, the fact that you have neo-Nazi groups in Russia, that's says something. And in the United States too, if you go to flea markets and stuff like that, in the middle of the country, you'll find Nazi memorabilia on sale, daggers and, you know, stuff that was brought back as war booty. And there is a kind of dark fascination that I think people have with it. It's also a way of irritating people as they know. But it also indicates something which I've, you know, you and I have discussed before, and that is the impact of the end of the living memory of World War II. So people aren't shocked by it in the way that I think they would have been, you know, 30 years ago, when you had plenty of people who had experienced the war around. And you wouldn't have had, I mean, imagine like Bob Dole. How do you think Bob Dole would have reacted to that sort of thing? A guy who fought, and was wounded fighting the Wehrmacht, to see people kind of reveling in Nazi memorabilia, or Nazi, you know, saying, "Well, I've got my inner Nazi," or it would be
unthinkable. I've got a kind of Nazi streak to me.
Yeah, it does. So I mean, it is troubling. Most of these people have no idea really what they're talking about. It's a way of showing how tough they think they are, or
how transgressive.
How transgressive they are. What is striking to me, though, is say, particularly in the case of the young Republicans in New York and Kansas, on the one hand, how pervasive that rot was. But I will also say that I was reassured somewhat that the local Republican parties reacted by dissolving those branches of the young Republicans and saying, we better fix this one. And now I don't know if that was simply being politically self-protective or they were genuinely appalled. I don't know if you have a view on that.
First of all, my view is that, as Politico said in what was clearly the understatement of the year, not a good look for the Republicans right. to have this you know, twice in 2 weeks, you know, episodes of, you know, kind of Nazi texts or pro-Nazi texts. Look, I think it is indicative, as you say, of a lot of rot. I worry, though, that this has become so mainstreamed.
Yeah,
it's, I mean, it's good that, you know, that the nomination of Ingrassia has been stopped by Thune and Rick Scott and a couple of others. I worry a little bit that this is just a function of the fact that he was meant to have a hearing tomorrow. And that you know, the kind of incident, you know, coming out just at the time of the hearing made it really awkward for them. How would they, you know, have reacted if this, you know, had stretched out for another couple of weeks? Because a lot of this stuff about Paul Ingrassia had came out when his nomination was first announced, and it didn't stop
him. And he was utterly unqualified anyhow. He just finally passed the New York bar. I mean,
No, of course. So, you know, I worry that the longer this goes on, the longer that Trump is there, the more this gets, you know, sort of into the interstices of the party, the harder it will be for this party to ever recover. And parties die. I mean, you know, in the U.S., it's not, you know, it's harder for ballot access purposes. But, I mean, look, the Tory party in Britain looks like it might be dying.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm not sure this party can ever recover.
So, you know, first I would say that, I mean, there's other very bad stuff. You look at Tucker Carlson, who was once, you know, kind of more or less mainstream, you know, seriously right of center, but giving a platform to people who are Holocaust deniers or think Churchill was the bad guy and the Germans had a point and all that sort of stuff. Absolutely, there's wrong. Look, I stopped identifying as a Republican in 2016 because I thought this was the direction it was going to go once they really bent the knee to Trump. I think it is rotten. And frankly, I think the Republican Party does deserve to disappear. The country would be better off for it if it just, you know, unfortunately degenerated into a kind of a, you know, a marginal party of kooks and creeps. And, you know, we get a new, I don't know, Whig Party or Federalist Party or
center right party of, yeah, that's not
center right party of some kind, because I tend to agree with you. I think, you know, that you have this rot in different parts of the party. And at the top, you have the most extraordinarily spineless collection of politicians imaginable. For me, I had never stopped to marvel at, you know, the party that produced people like John McCain produces the likes of Mike Johnson.
Yeah. Yeah. It is dispiriting. And I mean, look, the country needs two healthy parties.
Yep.
And right now we have kind of a half a healthy party.
Yeah, I agree. It'll give us plenty to talk about, Eric.
All right. On that appropriately gloomy note, we'll adjourn, but we'll be back next week.